Well, thank you very much, Gilbert and Karen. I have the utmost respect for people that do special music. I would rather give the sermon than do special music. And believe me, you should be happy that it's that way. Well, as was said earlier, it's always a privilege to speak at Sabbath services, but it's a special privilege to speak on this Sabbath, which will culminate in the marriage of Aaron and Amber. I'd like to thank Barry for the sermonette, which blends right in with what I'm going to say, and also to David Holliday last week for his sermon on about husbands. So I'm going to talk about marriage today, but a little different emphasis. For those of you who like titles, I actually have a title this week, which is rare. The title of my sermon is Becoming One. Becoming One. But before I get too serious, I'd like to ask how many of you have seen a copy of The Rules. A few have. I can tell some people are chuckling. There are some rules circulating around about marriage. There are some rules from the female side and some rules from the male side. I'm not going to dwell on the female rules. I think I'm almost certain they were written by a man. But here are the rules, some of them. Number one, the female always makes the rules. Number two, the rules are subject to change without notice. Number three, no male can possibly know all the rules. Four, if the female suspects the male knows all the rules, she must immediately change some of the rules. Number five, the female is never wrong. Number six, if it appears the female is wrong, it's because of flagrant misunderstanding caused by something the male did or said wrong. Number seven, if rule number six applies, the male must apologize immediately for causing the misunderstanding. And it goes on like this, so I'm not going to keep going. But there are some rules for the men as well. Rule number one. These are actually all labeled number one. But number one, Christopher Columbus did not need directions, and neither do we. Number one, all men see in only 16 colors, like Windows default settings. Peach, for example, is a fruit, not a color. Pumpkin is also a fruit. We have no idea what mauve is. Number one, ask for what you want. Let's be clear on this one. Subtle hints don't work. Strong hints don't work. Obvious hints don't work. Just say it. Yes and no are perfectly acceptable answers to almost every question. If something we said can be interpreted two ways, one of the ways makes you sad or angry, we meant the other one. Number one, we are not mind readers, and we will never be. Our lack of mind reading ability is not proof of how little we care about you. If we ask what is wrong and you say nothing, we will act like nothing's wrong. Only a couple more. It is neither in your best interest or ours to take the quiz together. No, it doesn't matter which quiz. Number one, I'm in shape. Round is a shape. Thank you for reading this. Yes, I know, I have to sleep on the couch tonight. But you know, we really don't mind that. It's like camping. You know, even though those are humorous, there's a certain amount of truth in it, which makes it humorous. And it also shows the conflict that can come up in a relationship, in marriage, when men and women who are different come together and try to become one. And believe it or not, I'm going to refer back to some of these later on, because they are touched upon in the Bible. First of all, I'd like to turn to Genesis 2. Genesis 2, starting in verse 21. Genesis 2:21, and the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So here we see that at creation is when marriage was established. There are two things that were established at creation, one of which was the Sabbath day, the other was the institution of marriage. So our Creator instituted marriage, and he made one woman for one man. He didn't make two or three, he just made one. I was looking in I have a 6-volume set of the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary, and I was looking in there under Genesis 2:24. This commentary was written in 1945, and two things that I noticed. One is that I think the English language has been dumbed down considerably, and the other is that it's written from a different perspective. And I'd like to read what they said about this passage, because from the Genesis account, this is what they had to say. A husband should have one wife, and one only during her life. In the adaptation of the sexes for such a close and indissoluble union, the wisdom and benevolence of the Creator are eminently displayed. The husband finds in the love and the life of woman what was wanting to the perfection of his own character, and the wife enjoys in the man the counselor, the guardian, and the friend whom her gentler nature requires. The former has his temper, his passions, his sorrows, produced by the cares and turmoil of the world, soothed or dispelled by the warm affection, the ready sympathy, and the faithful and delicate nature of the latter. And both having the same common interests, are led to study each other's dispositions, to bear one another's burdens, to help each other's infirmities, so that by the growing assimilation of tastes, the identity of aim, and the reciprocities of attachment, provision is made for increasing and riveting the mutual bond that unites them. It's kind of written like a sentence the Apostle Paul would write. But isn't that interesting? So what does it take to become one? To take two people and to unite them in aim and in their being. What does it take to become one? It takes three kinds of love in the marriage union to become one. The first kind of love I'd like to talk about is agape love. This is love that is God's love that comes through the indwelling of God's Holy Spirit. It's interesting, those of us who stay for the wedding tonight, there's I don't know exactly which wedding ceremony is going to be used, if it's the one that is put out by the church or not, because it doesn't have to be. But in the wedding ceremony that is put out by United, it includes a covenant with God. And it's a covenant with God to love, that is agape, one another. Agape love in a marriage is an unconditional, unselfish giving. Another way to say it would be a willful commitment to give. It's a willful commitment, a lifelong commitment. Agape love is not a feeling-based love. You know, through society we're told that love is a feeling, but agape love is not based in feeling. What if God didn't happen to feel like loving us sometime? You know, that's not the way God's love is. He loves us at all times. Agape love is will-based. It's based on our will to love and our commitment to love. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 13. Starting in verse 4. We'll talk more about this later in a different segment of my sermon, but 1 Corinthians 13:4 says, I'm reading out of the King James Version, which says charity, and the New King James, I believe, says love. Charity suffers long and is kind. Charity envies not. Charity vaunts not itself, which means it doesn't, my margin says, doesn't push itself forward. Is not puffed up. Does not behave itself unseemly, seeks not her own, is not easily provoked, thinks no evil, in my margin says, is not ready to suspect evil. Therefore, if something we said can be interpreted two ways, and one of them makes you angry or upset, we meant the other one. It doesn't think evil, it's not ready to suspect evil. Rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. You know, love is given. You know, in a relationship, we can give love. You know, we can't force love back. We have to give that love. This is the commitment and the willful love in a relationship, in the institution of marriage, that will hold it together for better or for worse. It helps bridge the gaps. You know, there will be times when you may not be too happy with your mate, but the commitment to the institution of marriage and the commitment to make the marriage work can hold it together when nothing else will. So let's talk about the next type of love that really needs to be in a marriage to become one. And that is philia, which is brotherly love, fondness, affection, the cherishing that happens in marriage. Let's turn to Romans 12 and verse 10. Romans 12:10. Paul says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another. So in brotherly love, in a marriage, we prefer one another. We're kindly affectioned one to another. We cherish one another. Cherish is an interesting word. It means to highly value, to hold in high esteem. This is the sharing aspect of marriage. There's a bumper sticker you've probably seen that says, happiness is marrying your best friend. And that's really very true. Your mate, if your mate is your best friend, that helps your oneness greatly. This is the sharing aspect of marriage, where you have common interests. It's so nice if you, you know, both enjoy doing the same things and can spend time together And time is just so important to spend together. I remember somebody wanted to get a hold of me one time, and I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you call me between 7 o'clock and 7:30 in the morning, my wife and I will be sitting down having coffee together in the living room. It doesn't matter what day. And the guy just went, what? I can't believe that your life is that structured. You know, and it's like, well, I mean, it's not totally structured, but that's one thing you could count on. Because when you set aside time like that to communicate, just to talk with one another so you know how you feel, and just you can really get to know somebody that way. Just to communicate, set aside time. And just enjoy time together and do things together and really nurture that friendship and the cherishing of one another through this philia, this brotherly love, to be good friends. So not only is there the commitment of agape love, but there's the fondness and the friendship, the cherishing of the philia love. Now we go to eros, which is romantic love. You know, God made sure that the human race would go on by giving us certain drives. But he also gave us an avenue to channel those drives in a positive and productive way that helps to stabilize society. And this is marriage and family. Over time, different societies have played with the basic building block of society, which is the family. I know the communists tried, you know, putting all children in state schools and basically dissolving the family and so forth. And they found out that the repercussions were awful. And they went away from that. Because the family is the building block of society. And of course, we believe God. We believe the Bible on faith. But it's also, when you put it into practice, it proves itself out in real life. God's ways are the best ways, and they bring happiness and true satisfaction. So romantic love is designed to be within a marriage. It's designed to be within that safe haven where there is agape love and philia love. But romantic love is important as well. There are romantic getaways. I know my wife and I enjoyed going to the ocean. There was a little cabin out there that we really liked. We always liked Hawaii. And it's important to spend that kind of time together, to enjoy one another's company in that way. I remember when Glenn White was here. Glenn White's a very down-to-earth man, and one of his sayings was, it's your marriage, roll in it. I have catnip at home. I don't have cats, but I have neighbor cats, because I have catnip. But it's so interesting to watch them. They'll just roll in that stuff. They just enjoy it. And so that was his saying, you know, it's your marriage, roll in it. So we need these three types of love. If you have the commitment of agape and the fondness and the cherishing of philia and the romantic love of eros, then we can really become one. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about the world in which we live, about differing world views. This is just a short segment, but the Christian vision of man is that we are made in God's image, and that we're a work in progress, striving for ideals such as justice, love, truth, and beauty on earth. that we're a work in progress, striving for higher ideals than what we have now. And these ideals are real and unchangeable. Morality is defined by God, and it's not invented by us. That's one worldview. But we live in a society that has promoted a naturalistic view of man. And it's devoted to appetite and self-aggrandizement. And it's the antithesis of selfless spiritual aspiration. And society elevates subjective truth, what they call subjective truth, and denies universal truth or absolute truth. So my truth isn't necessarily what your truth is. In other words, and society redefines morality based on current thought. So what happens is, you know, what happens when you've lost that love and feeling? It's over. It's just over. See, we need those three types of love to really become one in marriage. And just from personal experience, you know, there are times when you'd better have some commitment because you're not gonna weather the storm without the commitment, without the friendship. So we live in this society where, you know, romantic love is pushed to the top and commitment is pushed to the bottom, when really commitment should be pushed to the top. And romantic love, although wonderful, is not the most important part of your relationship. So what about practical application? I've told some people that I was going to speak on lessons from 31 years of wedded bliss. Whenever I wanted to get Sherry to laugh, I would say, "Yes, we've enjoyed, you know, however many years of wedded bliss." She just rolled her eyes, you know. "Your dementia is kicking in, isn't it, you know?" There's a bumper sticker I like. It says, "Time is the best teacher. Unfortunately, it kills all of its students." Because looking back, you know, it's easy to say, well, I shoulda, coulda, woulda, and all that sort of thing. But it's really never too late. I would like to talk about some lessons learned through the decades of marriage. In Genesis 2, we read that a man should leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. There's a problem in some marriages, and it affected us in some ways. I'm not going to say anything derogatory towards anyone, especially Sherry, because too many of her friends are out there. But I wouldn't do that anyway. But you should leave your father and your mother and start a separate entity, a new family unit. And the discussions and decisions can be made between the husband and wife, and, you know, nobody else really needs to be brought into that decision-making process. So a new family unit should be created. And that does create problems sometimes, and it's just prudent to view that and to be aware that that is a possibility. Quite some time ago, probably 13 years ago maybe, I was planning on giving a sermonette, and I went around the congregation and asked the older married people, hopefully I didn't offend too many people, thinking they were, you know, old married people, but I asked them, I said, what advice would you give someone contemplating marriage? And the responses were very interesting. And I picked out the three pieces of advice that were the most common, and I thought they were the most important. And the first piece of advice was, marry someone who loves God more than they love you. And that's an interesting concept. But what it does is it brings agape love into your marriage. Because when you make God your partner and you love God more than you love your mate, you're putting your priorities correctly. And also it brings some other things to the table. You know, the institution of marriage is very important. And if you love God, primarily, then you value the institution itself of marriage, which is ordained of God. And you will probably do things to save a marriage that you might not do otherwise. Someone who loves God will strive to live God's way of life. And God's way produces good marriages. If you turn to Galatians 5:22, I think, you know, we know what this is. It's the fruits of God's Spirit. But when you read down through what this fruit is, it's obvious that if these things are in a marriage, it will certainly help the relationship and help you to become one. Verse 22, it says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, which would be agape love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. There are times in your relationship when, you know, long-suffering is required. You know, where mercy is required, it's a good place to practice these attributes. You know, gentleness, goodness, you know, meekness. You know, a marriage cannot help but be a better marriage when these things are present. So someone who loves God more than they love you. And I know in my marriage that was very, very true. And there are times when, you know, the commitment to marriage really was the only thing that held it together. And I'll talk more about that later. But so we need that commitment. Number two in this list of three things that in advice for people contemplating marriage. This is true whether you're talking about relationships, cars, houses. Number two is maintenance is cheaper than repair. And I'm going to dwell a little bit on this one. Let's turn to Proverbs 18 and verse 19. Proverbs 18 and verse 19. It says, a brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city, and their contentions are like the bars of a castle. So a brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city. And I would say a wife offended is harder to be won than many strong cities, because the relationship is so close. And contentions, which are differences of opinion, so forth, you know, just contentions, are like bars keeping you apart. And these can be many different things. There are just many things in a relationship that can cause contention, whether it's, you know, the in-laws or how to raise children or the finances or anything like that. But I would say be very, very careful not to offend or to violate the trust of your mate. This is not a secret because I gave a sermonette about it some time ago, but about 23 years ago, I quit drinking. But I had an alcohol problem, and this caused, you know, no matter what relationship you're in, it causes troubles. So this was causing a good deal of problem in my marriage. And it came to the point when there was actually a feast that Sherry went to one feast and I went to a different feast. And this is probably during about the same time that Mr. Luker came to visit me. He was our pastor at that time. This was back when you really didn't want a visit from him, you know? That's when, you know, he's gone from preaching to meddling, you know? But I'm glad, you know. It's one of those deals. Looking back on it, I'm glad. But it caused a good deal of trouble. And it really strained our relationship to where what was holding it together was the commitment and the commitment to the institution rather than the commitment between each other. But at the feast, by myself, I actually went with my brother. He was single at the time. And we went to the feast together. And I actually bought a book. You know, it says, Christopher Columbus didn't need directions, and neither do we. You know, it's a very difficult thing for a man who is not as converted as maybe they should be to read one of these books. But anyway, I bought Dr. Dobson's book, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. And about 80% of those books are sold to women. And the biggest question that Dr. Dobson gets on that book is, how do I get my husband to read this book? So anyway, I could read this book without Sherry knowing, right? That's a big key. But when we got home, the main thing I got out of the book, there were a lot of tips and, you know, different things in the book. But the main thing I got out of the book is to treat your wife with courtesy and respect. Just those two things. You know, I'm a contractor and I work in people's homes and so forth, and so many times people do not treat each other with courtesy and respect. I mean, I've seen cases where, you know, it's like, man, I want to get out of here before he kills her. But anyway, so we got back together and after the feast, and I did simply that. I treated her with courtesy and respect. And it's amazing what happened. It's just amazing the change that occurred. Because what happens is, you know, a man tends to demand respect. It's like you just demand it. You know, I'm the guy, you will respect me. But it doesn't work that way. And when, you know, when you do love your wife in the proper way and you treat her in the proper way, you know, with the proper love, courtesy, and respect, then they respond to you differently. You know, it's only natural that would happen. So it was pretty amazing to me, the turnaround. Of course, you know, and I quit drinking too, which helped, but even so, the change was quite amazing. I almost gave a sermon at one time. I have a lot of ideas that I don't carry through with. It's probably because God says, don't do that. But I was going to give this sermonette called How to Change Your Wife. Got your attention, didn't I? But basically, that's the way you do it. You know, if you change your... The only person you can change is yourself. If you change yourself, the way people react to you changes. Now, one point on this whole thing of offending your mate or violating their trust is, you know, a man tends to think, well, I asked for her forgiveness and she forgave me, so it's all over, right? Why are you laughing? But what I found in actual fact is that it's like I quit drinking, okay. 6 months later, it's like, you know, how much trust is there? Well, you know, not very much. A year later, well, it's getting better. 5 years down the road, man, I think he might have changed. 10 years down the road, well, yeah, you know. 20 years, it's kind of okay. So, it's not fast. So maintenance really is cheaper than repair. I mean, you do not want to violate the trust of a close friend, or especially a mate. Number three on this list was read the manual. And that's, of course, talking about the Bible and other things as well. Like I read that one book, you know, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women. But there are a lot of other books. That's a very old book now, but still a very good book. This is still under the category of, you know, we don't need direction. But we really do. You know, there was one tip out of the book that was so practical and so logical, but nobody uses. That was just, it was just amazing. And that is, when someone gets home, whether it's a child or a spouse, give them 15 minutes of peace before you land on them with the list of things to do. And we did this at home, and it's amazing what a difference that makes. You know, you've been out, you know, all the cares of the world and working and all the problems at work and all this sort of thing. And then you come home, which is a sanctuary, and if you just give someone 15 minutes or until they say, okay, I'm ready, which I did a lot. Sometimes I'd get home and say, okay, I'm ready, you know. But other times, you know, 15 minutes later, she'd say, well, you know, car's got a flat tire and, you know, roof leaks. And so there are some very logical things to do in that regard. And then if we do make positive changes in our life, you know, we should all be growing in the Christian walk and be growing in patience and love, and as the years go by, everything should be getting a little better. And as we make positive changes, the way we relate to our mate will change, and then the way they react to us will change as well. It's a good place to practice long-suffering. You know, it took a long time for, you know, most of you knew Sherry and I in the last 10 years of our marriage. You weren't really, I don't remember too many of you that really knew us during those times. So you see the end product of years and years and years of growing together, and most of the big hurdles were jumped over and so forth. But you do grow together over the years. You know, love grows as time passes and you spend more time together. But it takes those three kinds of love, the agape love, the commitment, and the friendship, and the romantic love, the combination of those two, to grow together over the years. to create the kind of relationship that you're looking for. Another lesson that I've learned over time, and more towards the end of our marriage, and that is to use trials to grow together. Use trials to grow together. As I mentioned, I'm a contractor, so I work in people's homes, and sometimes I end up kind of like the painter in Murphy Brown, you know, where you just kind of move in, you know. I might as well have a room. And I did a couple jobs on Mercer Island that were that way, and got to know the people very, very well. And there was one family who, it's like this one lady, her dad was a doctor, she married a doctor, her son was a doctor, her daughter was married to a doctor, everyone was a doctor, you know. And her son had a very successful practice, was doing quite well, thank you, a couple children, and he got MS, and it just knocked him right out of his practice. And his wife left him. You know, she just couldn't handle that. So he was living, she was a antique dealer, and she had this little cottage on her property on Mercer Island, and he moved into that cottage. And he got progressively worse, and over time, you know, occasionally even I helped him to, like, get from the car to his place. But that's an example of, you know, how a real problem can come between people if they don't have, you know, the commitment to stay the course. When Sherry was hospitalized, you know, it was a real shock, of course, you know, to be, you know, married for so many years, and then, you know, she landed in the hospital for 6 weeks, and, you know, kind of wore a rut between my house and the hospital. But through that, I think we really got to know each other better. And even though it was a, you know, it was a real ordeal, that, you know, through the interaction and through, you know, the dependence on one another, that it really helped our relationship instead of damaging it. One time, it's kind of a funny little story. You know, I got to know sides of her that I didn't know before, sort of. And one time Frank Lepp went to visit her, and Frank was kidding with her and said, yeah, I'll race you down the hall, you know. And so Sherry just shed her, you know, like her gown on, you know, and she just spread that out and showed him the scar. I don't think so. But, you know, it's interesting, in this section of our relationship together, I'd like to talk about submission. You know, in Ephesians 5, and 21, 22 in there, where it talks about husbands, love your wives, you know, he kind of hit the core of the issue there. If a husband loves his wife with these three kinds of love, then she is not afraid to place her life in his hands. And it's an interesting thing to look at, the dynamic of it. You know, society tells us that, you know, submission is a bad thing, assertiveness is a good thing, be your own person is a good thing. It's amazing. My son and I commute together, and we have this little thing going. It's like, if there's an aggressive driver, you're cutting in and out of traffic and roaring up to the next person and all that stuff, you know, I'm sorry, but about 80% of the chance, it's a young woman. you know, it's just drummed into him now, you know, to be assertive and to be, you know, go after it. But you can't make a woman submit. By definition, you can't do it because it's a voluntary thing. And I think in the last year of our marriage that Sherry, you know, trusted me to the point that she would do that. And it was a very good thing. It was a very, you know, it made me love her more. And it made everything, you know, work very well. You know, and I'm not saying that from a, you know, a guy's point of view or, oh, yeah, you know. It wasn't that way at all. So through these trials, really our relationship was the best it had ever been. And we were able to, you know, to do some of the things that, you know, I talked about earlier, you know, to have some of these getaways and so forth where, you know, we actually went to Hawaii when it wasn't the feast, you know, which was really nice. We stayed close to Lahaina where the feast was, but you just can totally relax and enjoy one another's company. And it was really a wonderful thing. And if you don't take vacations together, please do, because it can really enhance your relationship to just learn to do things together. So grow together through trials. I didn't really mention child rearing, but you know, a lot of times families can, you know, the husband and wife can stay together through the child rearing years and kind of grow apart. But you can really use that to grow together as well. You know, you'd call that a trial if you want. But I still have a good relationship with both of my boys, and that's a wonderful blessing to have that. So in conclusion, men and women complement each other. You know, we aren't the same. We complement one another. And there's a mutual dependence. As I read from the commentary, there's a mutual dependence one upon another. Ephesians 5:21 says, submit one to another. Because there are times when, you know, the counsel of your wife is the best counsel you can take. You know, you are the captain of the ship, yes. But without that input, you know, I used to kid about, you know, wow, if I wasn't married, wasn't in the church, you know, I'd be in a cabin in northern Idaho with my gun and my dog, you know. You know, it's a good balancing. You know, we need that nature of the woman. So we are mutually dependent on each other. And this love develops over time based on trust and caring. That over time, we can truly become one through the trust and the caring. Real love is never a power struggle. You know, we never had a power struggle. You know, we were both the same temperament. You know, we're both non-combatants. But one time we staged this little mock battle for our kids. They were back in the back bedrooms, and we had this little shouting match going on, and they ran down the hall, and these two heads went, poof, poof, you know, around the corner. And then we just grinned at them, and they went, oh. We thought you were really fighting, you know. But the key to a happy marriage is true love by the husband and loving submission by the wife. Marriage is a tremendous opportunity for growth. A tremendous opportunity. It's a lot of work, but it's well worth the effort. You know, it's a lot of work to submit to Jesus Christ, but it's well worth it. Not only in this life, but in the life to come. So we have this tremendous opportunity. It's a wonderful blessing given to us by the Creator to be able to start these family units through marriage. So in conclusion, the real conclusion, you know, we have this opportunity for this wonderful foretaste of the joy that is to come in the world tomorrow.